This morning we're going to take a look at a guy that we have probably studied a ton when we were younger. But before we do that, I just want to go through some of the stuff that we looked at last week. I know so this is kind of a drop in and out, although as the quality of the food increases, I notice that people are coming more regularly, and I appreciate that. This is amazing. I've heard talk that they're going to be building some dorms nearby so that it'll be kind of like the Hampton Inn. You'll just have a hot breakfast. But we had looked last week at the nation of Israel, and one of the things that I had said, and Ron reiterated this morning, that God really hates the grumbling of the grumblers he loves. And I think you've got to be real careful. God doesn't hate grumblers. God hates grumbling. And it's just a perennial problem for us as believers to lose track of what we have, focus on what we don't have. The fact that God is good is not just a neat little colloquial saying among believers. It's really true. Regardless of where you and I are in life, if we gaze around us, we'll find ourselves to be blessed. I'm reminded of the fact that 2/3 of the world lives on $2 a day. And we are still in good shape. But it's a big deal to God. He deals with it in the book of 1 Corinthians. He deals with it in the book of Hebrews. He deals with throughout the Psalms. If you read the Psalms, they keep going back to that. It was a big deal. Second thing, and we talked about this as well, is that ingratitude is the first step away from God. And I think this—the reason I camped on this last week—is because it seems like such a small thing compared to the sexual perversity that's at the end of that chapter. And we tend to think, well, these people are—you know—you have this perverse sexual lifestyle, and people are applauding people that live that way, according to what Paul says in Romans. For crying out loud, all I do is complain a little bit about this or that. But it's a slow journey away. Matter of fact, one of the powerful statements, and C.S. Lewis develops this in Screwtape Letters, but is this principle that error increases with judgment, or error increases with distance. And the longer I'm off track a little bit over time, the more I'll be off track. To illustrate that, if you put an apple between someone's ankles at one end of a football field and sight in a rifle and shoot it out from between their ankles, and then put the apple keep it there and move the rifle up about a quarter inch, the bullet will go through their forehead. And it's just that the longer it travels, the greater the distance in terms of being off mark. And this is why I think complaining and ingratitude is such a serious thing for us. Huge area of struggle in my life. And the third thing, and Ron talked about this, which I think is so important, is just that a thankful mouth yields a grateful heart. If I wait for my heart to be grateful, it's not going to happen. Some of the stuff that we want in our Christian lives that we think has to be there by virtue of the right heart, God wants to put in there in the midst of a wrong heart. And sometimes it's doing the right thing biblically. I don't mean socially. I mean doing the right thing biblically over time that transforms me, as opposed to the Spirit of God getting some kind of smoke from my bedpost at night and having an angel with a drawn sword tell me you need to start doing this. And this is really true in the area of, if I want to have a grateful heart, I just need to start speaking gratefully. All right, we're going to take a look this morning at Moses. I used this piece of art last week, and I realized I should have used it this week. But the illusion of indispensability. And this one, I was going through this and praying over it and thinking, you know, I wonder who this is going to touch, because this is a little more specific. But as I stand up here in front of you, this is something that has affected my marriage. This is something that has affected my parenting. This is something that has affected my ministry. And so I think that it touches us. And I want you, as we go through this, to look for some truth in here that meets you where you are. I want to read a little bit of scripture before we start here. Hebrews chapter 11, you can just listen along with me. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. For he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who's unseen. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch him. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. And the Egyptians, when they attempted, were drowned. That's a tremendous statement about Moses, the person we're going to look at this morning, that's in the New Testament. Let me go back to the Old Testament, go back to the book that Moses wrote, Numbers chapter 11. We looked at a little bit of this last week, but last week we talked about the grumbling of people, and we focused on Israel. I want to go back to that same incident, and this time focus on the leader. Listen to this. Moses heard the people weeping through their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant?" That's him. "And why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land you swore to give to their fathers'? Where am I to get meat to give all these people? For they weep before me and they say, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once. If I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness." All right. Now, something that we're not going to talk about this morning, and there is absolutely so much stuff in Moses' life. I probably could do 10 messages on Moses. But one of the things about Moses that I think is important for you to see as you look through his life in the Old Testament, Moses talked brutally, honestly with God. You will not hear Moses talking this way in front of the people of Israel. And there's a principle there about pouring out your heart when things are just overwhelming. Moses, for all his weakness, he was not a leader that stood up and complained and grumbled in the presence of the people. He went to the Lord with it in private. And some of the stuff he said was borderline. I mean, I look at things that God did in the Old Testament that people that did less, and I think the way he talked to Moses, you know, it's a good thing that you and I weren't God. We'd have nuked him on the spot. I mean, you and I are like that. I think you're like that. I'm like that. You know, if I was God, I would have sent a great white for Jonah. I wouldn't have sent a fish. I'd have thought, "You pitiful, whining little piece of nothing, I'm going to, you know, and take you right out." God's not like that, thank goodness. But that's a principle there, all right? I want to take us into this life of this guy. I had to do a little graphic voodoo on this magazine, but I want us to look at Moses, kind of the Moses that everyone talks about, the Moses that everyone knows from Sunday school, all right? And first thing I said was that he was the perfect pattern. Moses is every Sunday school teacher's dream. I mean, where else in the Bible can you get a year's worth of stories, all right? Or movies. Look at this classic symbol, Yul Brynner. For those of us that are a little older, remember Cecil B. DeMille's classic movie, The Ten Commandments. And Yul Brynner sits on that throne at the end and he says, "Moses, God is God." Which is great for the movie, but in the scriptures, Pharaoh drowned with his soldiers. But it works good for Hollywood to have him alive for that line. But you've got all this stuff with the 10 plagues. You've got the Passover. You've got the parting of the Red Sea. You've got this just spectacular series of stories that we all kind of grew up in. Makes for good flannel graphs, makes for great Sunday school curriculum. And he's also an amazing leader. So you've got this persona of Moses that's overwhelmingly positive. All right, second thing. He had an amazing family. There was no priesthood at this time, but he was both his mother and his father are from the tribe of Levi. All right, so he came from this, what's going to become one of the most significant family lines in the people of God. Matter of fact, his brother, Moses' brother, is Aaron. And out of Aaron is going to come the line of high priests. So he comes out of this family that's going to eventually be renowned, even though in Egypt they were just one big part of a bigger pile of Jews, all right? Third thing, he's got this providential preservation, all right? He's not only spared, and the story of him being spared is amazing. He's supposed to be killed. Moses is supposed to be killed. And his mom and dad have some sense that there's something different about this. Pharaoh has sent out an edict that all the male children are supposed to be killed. And so they build this little ark, is what the Hebrew word is, and they put it in it, cover it with tar, and just float it out into the bulrushes along the Nile while Pharaoh's daughter is there bathing, all right? And I don't know if you've thought about this, but Pharaoh's daughter did something that was illegal. She kept this Hebrew child, knowing full well that her father had made a pronouncement that they were supposed to die. All right? Some scholars, and I think it's cool, but some scholars think that this was probably Hatshepsut, the female daughter of Pharaoh that eventually became Pharaoh herself when her son died, and wore a beard and tried to basically be a man. She was a rebel from the get-go. And here's God using a form of civil disobedience to preserve Moses. He's brought into the home of Pharaoh, all right? After he's nursed for 3 years by his own mom, all right? And Miriam, Moses' sister, is standing in the bushes watching this, runs over to Hatshepsut or whoever the Pharaoh's daughter was and says, I know someone who can nurse this baby. She's my mom, doesn't tell her that. And Moses' mom. And so Moses lives with his mother probably till age 3. And if you've got kids, those of us that have raised children know the tremendous impact that takes place between those first 3 years in terms of your identity and who you are. We've got a perfect explanation for why Moses felt this attraction to his own people when it comes time to deliver them. All right? Fourth thing, he got, I put this as kind of a fancy word, but he got an amazing education, privileged pedagogy. He had at least 35 to 37 years of the best education on the planet. On the planet. All right? You talk about structural engineering, you talk about mathematics, you talk about astronomy, chemistry, philosophy, hieroglyphics. He got all of it. We find this in the book of Acts. Stephen tells us that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of Egypt. You go to 1 Kings. Solomon's wisdom is compared to the being greater than all of the wisdom of Egypt. So the academic standards in Egypt were well known in the ancient Near East. And so you got this guy that gets this long, long, long Ivy League education. He's got more degrees than a thermometer as far as his education, all right? Just got tons of education, which to me strikes me as interesting. Whole nother message, but strikes me as interesting that God gave him 40 years of privileged education so that he could be the leader of 2 million illiterate people. The people that he led out of Egypt were illiterate. They didn't have time to change their mind, much less study. There were no scriptures at the time. There was nothing. And so here you've got a guy that's highly trained in one area to do a task that's totally outside his skill set. All right? Some of us have been there. Understand that. All right? Matter of fact, I'm convinced that Moses' real training took place in the second 40 years, taking care of sheep that weren't his, because God gave him a big pile of sheep that weren't his, and they were about as smart and obedient as the sheep he took care of in the land of Midian. I think Moses' real training took place doing, and listen to this, Moses' real training took place being faithful to something he did not enjoy. His call to greatness came out of the midst of faithfulness to something he did not enjoy. If you go back to the book of Genesis, at the very end, you'll find out something very interesting. Shepherds were an abomination to the Egyptians. They were an abomination to the Egyptians. God put Moses in a training program that, for his own understanding growing up, this is the worst possible job I could possibly have. And out of that came the deliverer, not out of the 40 years of education. I think his education was instrumental in all the things that we get in terms of the writing of the law. He understood Egyptian law. He understood how treaties were put together and the Deuteronomic covenant. All the stuff that's in the Old Testament came out of the brilliant education that Moses got. He was a great leader. He understood how to put together a rudimentary army and all this stuff. But in terms of his leadership for the people, it came out of an abominable job that he had. All right. Other thing, he was what we could call a preeminent pioneer. Matter of fact, this is my and this stuff I love to teach on this because we tend to gloss over this stuff and try to get, well, what's Moses got to do with me? Moses has a whole lot more to do with us understanding his life than it does just some of the principles we glean from it. All right. If you go into your Bible, you're going to find out something real interesting is that Moses gets more ink than Abraham. In the Old Testament, he's mentioned almost four times as much as Abraham. He's mentioned more than Abraham in the New Testament. He's mentioned more than Abraham in the Gospels. He's a key player. When you get to the book of Hebrews, he gets almost as much ink as Abraham. So this guy's important in the overall economy of God, all right? And the last thing, and this might surprise you, he's got what I would call a permanent position. You get to the book of Revelation, you get into heaven, and there's two songs that they're singing. They're singing the song of the Lamb, and they're singing the song of Moses. They're singing the song of Moses, and the song of Moses is in the book of Deuteronomy. So he's a key player, all right? He's an important person. That's kind of the man of the year. That's the background. But if you take it a step further, all right, there was a problem. I may have to explain this. My wife said, you're going to have to explain this to the younger guys because he's dead. There was a singer, a lounge singer named Frank Sinatra, and in a galaxy far away, and he had a song called I Did It My Way, and there's a line in there, I'm not like those who kneel and pray, I did it my way. And I want to show you something about Moses that I think was at the heart of his discouragement. We saw this passage in Numbers where he said, kill me, just kill me, all right? And Jonah said that. Elijah said that. They all wanted God to kill them because they didn't feel good about doing it themselves. And they were just discouraged. And Moses got to that place. And I want to show you, I think, the reason that Moses got to that place. And we're going to go back. We're going to go back and take a look in his early years, all right? And I put in his youth. I was trying to figure out how you do this. Moses lived to be 120 years old. If you set up a ratio, and I'm not going to die for this, but if you set up a ratio for 70 years, which the Bible says is an average lifespan at that time in the book of Psalms, and 120 years, Moses was at age 40, Moses was about a college graduate. He was about 22, 23. And those of us who are older remember those years. That was the one little period of my life when I knew everything. Graduated from college, I felt like I knew everything. Life was simple. Used to be able to solve world problems around the student quad with a Coke and about five of my buddies. You know, you give a couple hours and it wasn't that complicated. I don't know why it took people so long. Then I became a research chemist for the EPA when the Clean Water Act came out. And I did that for 5 years and I realized that cleaning up pollution in this country was an arduous, complicated mess. Even though we could, it was really easy when I was in college. We just made signs and stood outside nuclear reactors and, you know, you get up in the morning, you put your garbage on the curb, you come home, it's gone. I mean, what's so complicated about that, you know? But I was working 60, 70-hour weeks just trying to figure out how to get the water cleaned up for one industry. And there's a tendency among youth to take complex issues and make them simplistic. And I think in Moses' early years, he decided that the best thing to do was just take matters into his own hands, and he killed this Egyptian. You remember this story? There was an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. And Moses jumped in, killed the guy. And I don't know if he thought he was going to be the deliverer and start it. There's some people think that he kind of got this image that he's going to deliver his people. There was a promise that God was going to do that. But he jumps in and does it his way and ends up in the wilderness for 40 years. All right. Second time you see this is in midlife. All right. You've got experience, all right? You had no experience but just education when he was younger. Midlife, I'm putting him around 80 here, all right? you've got the experience, you've got the right time, but you have him trying to do something without God. You get to Sinai in Exodus 18. And there's a ministry here that I just heard this morning called the Jethro, what's it called?
Jethro
Associates, all right? You got Moses outside, all right, right, parked at Mount Sinai, and his father-in-law comes to talk to him. And he watches him. And Moses is sitting judging the people of Israel all day long. And his father says, you're trying to do this all by yourself, all right? Well, if you follow this pattern in Moses' life, and I'm going to show you the most significant one at the end, this was Moses' weakness. This was his Achilles heel. Moses wanted to do things my way. It's either my way or the highway. And when the highway ran out, he said, kill me. He said, kill me. But in Exodus 18, you got the right time, all right? The right experience, but the wrong approach. He's trying to do this himself. Happens again. They run out of food. Numbers 11, that was the passage that we were looking at, all right? And here you got the right man, the right experience, but the wrong perspective. Same thing. He said, I read that passage to you. Kill me. I can't do this by myself. Did I give birth to all these people? You keep reading, and God says, I want you to get 70 elders from your people, and I'm going to put a portion of my spirit on them, and they're going to help you with this. All right? Moses said, I can't do this by yourself. And God kind of goes, hello. Moses, we've been here. This is the third time we've been here. We were here in Egypt. You tried to kill the Egyptian. All right? Exodus 18, at the base of Mount Sinai. We're here again. Appoint elders. All right? Which means what? Which means there was capable people in his midst that could help him. He just needed to tap them. All right? Third one, and this is the one that I've heard a lot of misteaching on, and I hopefully try to clear this up a little bit. They come to this place called Meribah, and they run out of water again. This is the second time this happened. Moses pours his heart out before God, and God says, I tell you what, I want you to go, and I want you just to speak to this rock, and I'll give the water to the people, right? And this is where Moses strikes the rock, all right? And you need to look at this passage real carefully. You need to look at it here, and you need to look at it in the book of Deuteronomy, because the problem isn't that he struck the rock. I've heard it taught that, you know, God said speak to it, and he struck it with a stick, and God said, blew the whistle and said, out of the game, you're out. Can't go in the promised land. You struck it with a stick, for crying out loud, Moses. That's terrible. But if you read the passage, that's not the problem. The problem in the passage is that the words. Moses says, do we need to give you water? Do we need to give you water? And God says, because you did not exalt me as holy, you will not enter the promised land. And I don't know that Moses ever got this. I don't know if this ever sunk in, because at the end of his life, in Deuteronomy 3, he says, but because of you, the Lord was angry at me. He still seems to be blaming the Jews for his conduct. But what he did there was the wrong attitude. Moses says, do we need to bring you water? And that's when God jerked him out of the game. He said, you're benched. You don't get to go into the promised land. All right. Now, he did go in. I think I've told you that before. Moses did get to go into the promised land on the Mount of Transfiguration. He was there with Jesus. And that's pretty amazing. But that was after he died. But you've got this tendency, and I want you to see this. Moses' weakness was, I want to do it my way. All right? And God had a solution for that. God had a solution for that. Delegate. Delegate. You see it in at least two or three instances in Moses' dealings with his people. All right? First time it came through the counsel of Jethro. This guy's a Gentile. He's not even a Jew. All right? And what's his counsel? In a nutshell, and this is important for some of us, all right? Some of us in this room, all right, and I'm a prime example of this, this is not a pastoral we, where the pastor means you, but he says we. I mean us, all right? Truthfully, some of the reason that we are just overwhelmed has to do with this principle, all right? And Jethro's counsel was simply this: don't do what others can do. You've got other people that can do this. Let them do it. That was his counsel. You do the stuff that they can't do. Stuff they can do, let them do it. Now, there's a reason that that doesn't happen. We're going to look at that, right? Second thing, he got the counsel directly from the Word of God himself. All right? And God had a really interesting thing. He said, Moses, just use what you already have. He doesn't tell him, don't do what others can do. He says, use what you already have. And in this case, it was 70 elders. He said, they're there. All right? They were elders. They didn't have to do a talent search and fill out a form. Moses knew who they were. He knew what their capabilities were. He knew that they were leaders. And God says, use them. Okay. Now, what I want to do is take him into the modern world. Let's take a look at, you know, how do you and I fall into this trap that Moses fell into? All right? Four errors. All right? Excuses. Four excuses. First one. I don't have time to train someone to do this. Now, lest you think I'm talking about the office, lest you think I'm talking about the corporate world, the applications for this in parenting are absolutely huge. All right? I spent nearly 30 years in secondary education working with the children of Christian parents. And it just blew my mind how some of them did not know how to do some common tasks. I had a girl once in detention. And she didn't know how to turn on a vacuum cleaner. She said, I don't know how. It's not real complicated. On, off, there's a switch right there. But she had never done it. Had no idea how to run a vacuum. How to change oil in a car. How to balance a checkbook. How to remember to bring your lunch to school. It just blew my mind. Every day, harried mothers usually driving in with their child's lunch because they forgot it. And I told the moms, I said, you know, if you just leave the lunch at home, your child's not going to end up as a Biafra poster child. You know, they're not going to end up. It'd be good for them. We had a band teacher at one of the schools I taught at that I saw students marching at halftime with no shoes on, because they forgot their band shoes, and he would not let them call their family. I saw a kid marching with no instrument. Like this, with no instrument. Now, how many times do you think that happened? You say, well, that destroyed his self-esteem. I don't think so. Because I had him in class, he was full of it. All right. He had lots of the truth is, and this is just a statistic. The truth is, if I take an hour to teach someone a 10-minute task, I'll save myself 40 hours a year. That's a week of work. But the principle here is that sometimes we just don't take the time to pass off to someone else something they could do, whether it's at home, whether it's at the office. One of the places where we lived, I had a neighbor that every weekend mowed his grass while his two sons sat inside watching football on television. And you train a child that things will get done by someone else if you do it yourself. Second excuse. I'm the only one who can do this right. This one probably is getting the meddling with some of you. I'm pretty anal about stuff. As a matter of fact, one of my board members last night made a statement. I said, do you think I'm anal? And they looked at me and they said, anal? Yeah, probably only second to me, they said, because of the way I pack up my equipment when I come to teach someplace. And the reason is because I've gone places to teach and reached for something and it's not there because it's someplace else. But the idea that no one can do this right except me, the real truth of that is that right is not always the best standard. Good enough. And I'll tell you this. I don't think there's a right way to mow a lawn. I do think there's a right way to shut down a nuclear reactor. I do. And I'm grateful for the protocols for shutting down a nuclear reactor. But I don't think there's a right way to make a bed. I don't think there's a right way to mow a lawn. I don't think there's a right way to do dishes. And you and I are in the office. Is there a right way to stock a shelf? All right. Now, there's things that cause inconvenience, and you can explain that, but sometimes the right way is my way. And if you want to do it the right way, you have to do it the way I do it. And if you're not going to do it the right way, my way, then I'll just do it myself. And what happens is over time, there are lots of people, those of you that are in management understand this, there are lots of people that will gladly let me do it my way. And over time, what's supposed to be someone else's job becomes my job. And the longer I do it, instead of it being an extra thing, we're going to look at this in a second, it becomes an expectation. And then when you don't do something that you shouldn't have been doing in the first place, after a certain period of time, there are people that are either really disappointed or frustrated because that's your job. And it's never been your job or my job. Third one, if I don't do it, it won't get done. Truth is, this is often driven by two things. One is fear of conflict. Some of us just don't want the conflict of having to remind someone. We don't want to discipline them. We don't want to punish them. We don't want to withhold privileges from them. And I'm going to tell you this, and my kids are gone, and they're out of my house. I'm still a parent. I'll be that way till I die. But I will tell you this without apology. You don't negotiate with your children. You just don't. I mean, it just blew my mind all the years watching parents negotiate with their children. You know, they would ground them for a certain period of time, those that did, all right? And then they would negotiate the grounding. The kids would. And they'd always get it reduced. It was like plea bargaining, you know? And I think that's not something I have to do. There's a lot of parenting in this modern age. There's a lot of parenting driven by fear of their children. I read one place, a guy said, we live in a filiocracy, a world that's run by children. And children need parents a lot more than they need friends in terms of guidance and that stuff. It's vital. And sometimes we just do things ourselves because we don't want the conflict. And over time, we train people that way. We train people that way. The fourth excuse is it's my job. This is probably the one that I have fallen prey to the most. Now, do you understand the connection between last week and this week? What happens when you feel overwhelmed and overworked, underappreciated, underpaid? What comes out of our mouths? We start complaining, yeah. And so, and oftentimes in my case, and I have a wife that is not afraid to tell me the truth about myself, and I appreciate that. I've tried to learn from Pilate's error. He had a wife that came to him and said, I had a dream. I don't think you should have anything to do with that Jesus guy. He said, what do you know? Go back home. And so I listened to Jill. And there's a lot of times that things that I have done so long that are extra have just become part of my job. And I have often said to her, you don't understand what it's like to be a teacher. Which is true. She doesn't. She didn't. But that became an excuse for me to do extra things that I didn't need to do. I went into work early, counseled with students. I skipped lunch, counseled with students. Was gone on weekends, and it was all my job. It was all my job. I know a father that was gone 6 years in a row on his daughter's birthday. She sat down with him on the last time and said, Daddy, could you stay home? And he was in the ministry. And he said, honey, he said, this is what God's called me to do, and you know it's more important than your birthday. That's what he told her. So to punish her father, this is how high school students think, to punish her father, she jumped in bed with a guy she'd never met before, gave up her virginity, came and told me, this was in Colorado, high-profile Christian guy. I went, took him out for lunch, told him what had happened. He cried in his soup, and 3 months later, he was back on the road. Then she tried to kill herself. And that still didn't get his attention. Because why? Because it's my job. It's my job. And you just don't understand. You just don't understand. You don't understand the pressures that are on me. You don't understand the expectations that are on me. And if you sit down sometimes, beloved, and I'm just laying out my own failure here, you sit down and you lay out the list of things that occupy our seven-day period in a week, a good chunk of them are self-imposed. We either have failed to delegate, we either have failed to let other people do it because they can't do it as good as we can, or we've taken on things to reduce conflict with others. And I think sometimes we get to the place where we're absolutely against the wall, we're absolutely overwhelmed, we're absolutely wanting to quit, and we either grumble or we just become despondent. All right? And you and I in this room, every one of us responds to this differently. Some of you, when you're overwhelmed, you just withdraw. Don't even want to get out of bed. Others become meaner than a snake. Just become angry. And others, we shut people out. And I'm grateful that God met Moses in all these cases. And he said, Moses, delegate, delegate, delegate. I've got what you need is around you. You see this, a great example of this for a woman is in Martha and Mary, when they're sitting at Jesus' feet, if you know that story. And Martha gets really PO'd at Jesus and comes in and says, you know, don't you care? Don't you care that my sister's left me to serve alone? Tell her to help me. All right? Which means that she was helping her and left. And Jesus says, Martha, and when Jesus says your name twice, that's not good. He says, you know, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. One thing is needful. I think the point is there is he's saying, you know what, Martha, you got this big elaborate spread. I didn't ask you to cook this. One thing, bagels would have been fine. Come here. You got God in a body in your living room, and you're off in the kitchen. So she got consumed. And this happens to people in ministry, all right? Every need is not a call. Serving God is doing what he asks, not doing what we think Jesus would do necessarily. So it can happen to all of us. All right. Moses in the mirror. Oftentimes my refusal to delegate comes from, this is hard to say, but it's true, an inflated view of my own capabilities or my importance. Sometimes that's the reason. I've got an inflated view of my importance or what I can do. All right? Second thing, I'm going to say this slowly. I know you know this. I know I know this, but it's true. God doesn't need me. You, me, are completely dispensable. It doesn't mean I'm not valuable. Doesn't mean I'm not useful. Doesn't mean that God chooses in his grace to let me be a part of this amazing story. But he doesn't need me. All right? The health of the Church of Jesus Christ is not dependent upon hands of her. There's an old pastor in Nebraska. Every night before he went to bed, he used to throw open his window, lean on the windowsill and say, "Oh, world, I've done all I can for you today. If it's up to me, you'll just have to go to hell." Then he'd close the window and he'd go to bed. And I thought, you know, the first time I heard that, I thought, whoa, that's terrible. But you know what? It's true. It's true. We're dispensable. We're dispensable. All right? Third thing. All right? I need to accept the fact that delegating responsibility is biblical. It's fully biblical. It's God's plan, all right? And our greatest need as Christians is to live with a sense of need, a sense of need of God and one another. Economic crises that we're in, that helps it. Death of a spouse, that helps. Loss of a job, that helps. But when life is good, we kind of tend to live as though we don't need each other. And beloved, we desperately do. We desperately do. Second thing, it was God's solution to Moses' dilemma, delegation. I don't think I'm taking John Maxwell's leadership principles and applying to the Old Testament. I just think it's true. And third thing, it was Paul's standard for church growth. What you've heard from me, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. You read in the book of Acts, the first thing Paul did when he led people to Christ, he's planted a church. Then what would he do? He'd appoint elders. He'd appoint elders. All right? Here's what I've done with the time that's left. if you would, instead of printing those things out separately, I just put them up here. These are the questions that deal with this issue. And again, this touches us at different places. But look at these four questions, particularly the last one, how have you and I created a sense of indispensability on the part of someone else? What have I done? All right, look up here once. This is real important. If I have taken on other people's work, it's very likely that there are people that aren't doing what they should be doing. So I may have contributed to that. I may be sitting back. There may be some of us in this room that need the opposite issue, is that I need to step up, whether it's in church, whether it's at home, whether it's at work, that I've let something go. But think of these. Look at these four questions. Just bounce them around amongst yourselves and run with that. Let me close in prayer real quick.